From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, some painless saving strategies to start your new year.
No matter what kind of plan you're on, whatever you're doing right now, just add 2% as an increase for the next couple of years.
The focus continues to be fixed on science, technology, math classes, but what are Michigan kids losing?
We are one of four or five states currently in the United States that does not have a requirement or a mandate for music in elementary grades.
Leo Sarkisian is one of the world's leading collectors of African music.
Radio Comoros, Radio Tanzania, Radio Sierra Leone, Radio Liberia. There's hardly a national radio station that doesn't owe some debt of gratitude to Leo Sarkisian.
And now his collection has come to Michigan. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. A new year, a new budget, ringing in some changes that could affect your bottom line. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we'll serve up some money strategies to launch your 2015. Then later this hour, the future for music teachers in Michigan. But first, the 114th Congress gets to work tomorrow, a Congress that will be led by Republicans in both the House and Senate for the first time in 8 years. Todd Spangler, Detroit Free Press, D.C. reporter, is on the line. Hey, Todd, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
So we've got lawmakers, some returning, and some newbies coming for the very first time, and they start session tomorrow. What should we keep an eye on, especially as it pertains to Michigan?
Well, I think that, you know, especially as it pertains to Michigan, you're going to have to keep an eye on how these new members do and how they mesh in terms of a Congress that's going to have to figure out how it's going to work with the Democratic president. You're going to have Gary Peters coming in here for, you know, to the U.S. Senate. Democrats now in the minority in the Senate. Debbie Stabenow, you know, longtime senator who's going to be moving in the minority with him. You know, how are they going to get what Michigan needs in terms of funding and road and bridge money and et cetera, done in a Republican Congress? I mean, that's really what people are going to be waiting to see.
And when we look at, you know, five new members of Michigan's congressional delegation, what do you think we'll be seeing from them? I mean, real policy beyond just finding their offices and finding out where the bathrooms are.
Well, I think that, you know, there's going to be so much that's going to be done by this new Congress. And how they mesh with the Obama administration. These Republicans are going to come in, and, you know, for the state delegation, you have, sure, you have, you know, Congressman Peters becoming a senator, a Democratic senator in the Senate, you know, but you also have a couple of new Republicans in the House, in Dave Trott from Birmingham, and John Molinar from Midland, and Mike Bishop from Rochester. I mean, and they're going to be part of a stronger, larger majority in the House that's going to be trying to push the Obama administration to change the Affordable Care Act and pass the Keystone Pipeline extension. I mean, that's going to be one of the first things that the House and Senate try to do. And it's going to be a real question about how these members, you know, mesh with that other majority, that Republican majority. They will mesh, and they're going to vote, you know, along those ways. And those things are going to get passed through the House and the Senate. The question is whether or not they can form them in such a way that an administration can accept them or they get vetoed.
And there are these big national issues. You just referred to the Keystone XL pipeline. There's certainly immigration reform that has grabbed, you know, much of the front page attention. Right. How much do those two issues really affect Michigan directly?
Well, you'd have to say that in terms of anything that has to do with energy policy or anything that has to do with immigration does ultimately affect Michigan. Michigan is still a big state. Michigan is still a big state that sees immigrants come in. It is still a big state that relies a lot on, you know, energy policy. So insofar as those things have national impact, they're going to have an outsized impact on Michigan because Michigan is still a big state. Now, don't get me wrong. Michigan, you know, when it comes to immigration policy, is not nearly in the same kind of terms as a Texas or an Arizona or New Mexico or California. I mean, it doesn't hit in that same kind of level. But that doesn't mean it doesn't have an effect in Michigan and that people shouldn't be paying attention. They should be paying attention. And in terms of energy policy, really, you know, I know that soon-to-be Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was talking about making this Keystone vote a vote on an overall kind of energy policy, or at least a debate over an energy policy across the U.S. That could have significant impacts on what happens in Michigan in terms of, you know, electric plants and not to mention, you know, fuel efficiency standards in a state like Michigan and with the domestic automakers. There's just a lot of things that could lead into.
And then there's been so much talk here in Michigan debating over transportation and fixing infrastructure, but that debate's happening at the federal level as well. And we hear there's talk about a possible gas increase, gas tax increase. What's happening that you know of?
Well, this is one of those things that's going to have to get sorted out. And it's not going to be easy to sort out. You have, you know, hardline Republicans particularly who are against any kind of increase in taxes. But that being said, there seems to be an understanding on both sides that something has to be done to fix the Transportation Trust Fund. It's going to run out of money in May, the Federal Transportation mm-hmm. Trust Fund. And that funds a great deal of the road and bridge work across the country. The Obama administration is going to be pushing, I'm sure, for some kind of new taxes to help take care of that. At the same time, a lot of Republicans are going to be pushing against that, but realizing something has to be done. Listen, when the Republicans take over both chambers, as they will tomorrow, they're going to have to start working toward how do we figure these things out vis-a-vis acceptable policies with the administration. There are going to be a lot of fights over it, but a lot of those things, like this one, are going to have to be figured out.
And tomorrow in the House, there will, you know, getting things kicked off, there'll be a vote for Speaker of the House, currently held, of course, by John Boehner, but he's being challenged for his third term. Do you think all of Michigan's Republican congressional delegation would vote for Boehner?
No. I would guess, and I think it'd be a relatively safe guess, that Justin Amash, congressman from the Grand Rapids area, Cascade Township, you know, he'll be a vote against Boehner. He has in the past. I'd be very surprised if he voted for him this time. That being said, I would expect most, if not all, of the other Republicans in the state to back Boehner and Boehner to win, you know, pretty handily. You know, he can't be happy about being challenged in this way, but he also can't really be surprised by it. You have a very strong libertarian bloc. Amash is one of its key members in the House, and they're not going to go away anytime soon, and they're going to continue to push him to the right.
What else are you going to watch for, Todd? I'm wondering, is there something that could happen in this first week that will really be telling us how lawmakers will or won't work together in the upcoming season?
No. There's nothing that's going to happen this week that's going to really give anybody any indication of how this Congress and how both chambers of this Congress are going to work together. This is going to be a week where there will be posturing. This is going to be a week where some attention comes back to Congress. And so while there'll be a lot of talk about each side needing to come to the center, at the same time, both sides are going to be, you know, playing to their base, taking that attention and playing it up, particularly with the Keystone vote that we expect, you know, later this week, and a committee hearing on Thursday in the Senate Energy Committee, which, by the way, we expect Senator Stabenow from Michigan to be talking up, you know, amendments to that bill if it goes according to plan. So I think, no, I don't think you're going to be able to take this week's look and say this is how this new Congress is going to act, mostly because there are things down the road that Congress is going to need to do, Homeland Security funding, dealing with immigration, dealing with the Highway Trust Fund, that are going to require some sort of compromise. And that, down the road, is really going to show us what and how this Congress can do, if anything.
Todd Spangler, Detroit Free Press, D.C. reporter. Good to talk with you. The first of many conversations in this new year, Todd. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
President Obama will be visiting Detroit this week. What's bringing him to town? Zoe Clark is co-host of Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics. Zoe, why the New Year's visit?
Indeed. The president just can't quite get enough of the Michigan state. He was last here November 1st. So just what, a couple months ago, mm-hmm. I wanted to bring in the new year with us.
I guess
no,
so.
Really what's going on here is, of course, you know, presidents, they give the State of the Union addresses in the beginning of the year. Usually what we've seen past presidents do, at least in current memory, is they give the address and then they tend to go travel. They go to states or towns and sort of talk up their ideas.
So give the address and hit the road.
Exactly. President Obama saying, hey, 2015, let's throw things on our heads a little bit. He has decided he wants to talk about some of these policies that we will hear about the evening of January 20th, the State of the Union, ahead of time.
All right. Such as?
So here in Detroit, he is going to come to the Ford Motor Company, the Michigan Assembly Plant. plant
in Wayne
County, indeed. And he's going to be talking about what else? Auto manufacturing, the rebound of the auto sector. And you know, as this administration has shown time in and time again, they like the story. You know, just last week we heard from the Treasury Department that some, you know, $9 billion was actually spent on the auto bailout. But that is not going to deter this president, obviously, from continuing to talk about it.
So this is kind of a victory lap for the auto bailout,
you know,
to say, hey, everybody.
I'm not so much sure it's a victory lap, but it's more saying, hey.
Because it's kind of late for a victory lap.
Exactly. I think what it is highlighting yet again American industry and manufacturing. And coming back to also friendly grounds, the president has had friends here in Detroit and Metro Detroit. Mm-hmm. He tends to like it when he is here. Mm-hmm. You know, he got a Zingerman sandwich earlier year when he was here earlier in 2014. So, no, it's a friendly audience. It's something that he feels good that he can talk about. Then after that visit on Wednesday to Metro Detroit, he'll be going to Phoenix. He'll be talking about housing there. And then after that, he'll be traveling to Tennessee to talk about college costs and higher education. So these sort of three trifecta are, you know, most mm-hmm. likely what you are going to hear about in, you know, the State of the Union: housing, manufacturing, education.
So if you're on I-94 somewhere between Metro Airport and that Wayne Assembly Plant of Ford's, then just be prepared for traffic delays.
On Wednesday afternoon, mm-hmm. the president, I think, wheels down early afternoon. He's supposed to talk at about, I think, 4:05, just to be exact, in the afternoon. So I think he's only going to be here for like an hour or something like that. But yes, if you are driving, be careful because there will be a big motorcade.
Zoe Clark, co-host of Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics. Thanks, Zoe.
Thank you, Cindy.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of the world's most extensive and valuable collections of African music has come to the University of Michigan. It's the Leo Sarkisian Collection of African Music, and it's a mind-boggling collection. Just what does this significant collection of African music mean to scholars across many disciplines? Kelly Askew is here now with us. She's an associate professor in the departments of Anthropology and Afro-American and African Studies, and she's founding director of U of M's African Studies Center. Thank you for joining us today, Kelly.
Thank you for having me.
And we are so happy to welcome none other than Leo Sarkisian into the program. Leo is an ethnomusicologist. He was the longtime host of Music Time in Africa for the Voice of America. And Leo is kind enough to join us from his home in Maryland. Hello, Leo.
Hello, hello. It's happy to be here with you.
It's very good to have you with us. I want to start with you, Kelly, and describe to us just what is in Leo's collection and why the arrival at U of M is such a source of excitement.
Leo's collection has to be one of the most significant collections of African music in existence right now in the world. Unlike other collectors of African music who are driven by a particular passion, I mean, I know of a person who is absolutely passionate about Congolese popular music. Leo's collection represents every conceivable genre and variety of both rural and urban African music, and he has traveled to every country in Africa. There are very few people who can say that. And he was recruited very early on by, of all things, a company in Hollywood that had sought music in order to populate films coming out of Hollywood that could be about Asia, that needed films, film music from around the world. So he was hired by a company called Tempo Records. Colonel Irving Fogel went and recruited Leo, and he began his career recording in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Bangladesh, all over Asia and Southeast Asia and Central Asia. From there, after 3 years, he was asked by Colonel Fogel to now begin work in Africa, because that was 1957. Ghana was the very first sub-Saharan country in Africa to obtain its independence. And Leo was sent to Ghana and then Guinea in 1958 to start recording music of these brand new nations.
Track one, take one, Chedo.
Well, Leo Leo Sarkisian was born in 1921. He grew up in Lawrence, Massachusetts. His parents were Armenian, and they came to the U.S. from Turkey. He spoke three languages at home: Turkish, Armenian, and English. Leo was also a talented artist. In college, he studied art, he studied illustration, and then came World War II. He enlisted in the war, and he was recruited as a map maker. At that time, he landed in North Africa. Leo, take us past the war. It's a new world, a post-war world, and the world of broadcasting has grown incredibly, and you ultimately became the host of Music Time in Africa for the Voice of America.
Well, what led to that was, when I returned back from World War II, I immediately went to New York City, and there I was working as a commercial artist, but every evening I was at the New York Public Library, and I started going through what was written in books about world music, Chinese music, Indian music, African music. I just went through everything I could read every evening. Somehow, I just felt that there was always blanks because a lot of those things about the music of different countries was written by travelers, the first British travelers and the Portuguese and Arab travelers. And they would describe musical instruments. But yet, I, growing up as a folk musician and playing, I had a different feeling as I read what had been already written about music in those countries. And I started making notes, saying that I wish I could go to that country and really see what those musical instruments look like. And then one day I got a knock on the little room that I was living in just above Greenwich Village in New York City. And when I opened the door, there was this tall, handsome-looking man with a fancy coat and a hat with a feather in it. And all he said was, "I'm Colonel Fogel, president of Tempo Records in Hollywood. I've read some of your notes. Would you like to come and work for me in Hollywood?" Well, right then and there, it took me only a few seconds, and I turned my career from art, and I went to Hollywood.
What did that feel like as you were able to go to corners of Africa that most people maybe never could even imagine, and you could grab what they were producing in terms of music?
Well, I just felt at home. Leaving leaving the United States, the first country we landed in, of course, was Karachi, Pakistan, where Tempo Records that I was working for had already made arrangements. They wanted me to help to work in Pakistan radio to help the engineers and show them some of our recording techniques that we had back in Hollywood. And I was very, very lucky that at that time the head of music at Radio Pakistan, Mr. Galani, he took me. He said, "Let us start recording music in my country." He says, "There are many areas," he says, "that I haven't gone to, and let us go together." I traveled all over Pakistan with Mr. Galani and recording Pakistani music for Pakistan Radio.
Kelly, I want to ask you for a moment with this collection of Leo's. Give us a sense of the scope and how many pieces. What are you inheriting at U of M?
So Leo, part of his mission was to go and to collect music from all varieties of ethnic groups that might find their way into a Hollywood film at some point along the way. But while in Guinea, he went to Ghana, and then after that Guinea. That's where he was recruited by Edward R. Murrow to come work for the United States Information Agency and help these new independent nations of Africa set up their own radio stations. So as you heard, he'd worked with Radio Karachi, he'd worked with Radio Kabul. He arrived in Ghana and worked with Radio Ghana and Radio Conakry in Guinea. And he just continued. Radio Comoros, Radio Tanzania, Radio Sierra Leone, Radio Liberia. There's hardly a national radio station that doesn't owe some debt of gratitude to Leo Sarkisian for helping to train sound engineers, train people in how to cut and splice and create the radio shows that you yourself are also involved in making. So that's what he did, was going around, and as part of the practical training that he did in each of these countries, he would take sound engineers into the field to do recordings of their own country's heritage that would be used in these new radio station shows, but also for purposes of posterity, to document the cultures that existed, because coming out from under colonialism, colonial orders maintained the position that Africa had no culture. So it was very important. Country after country established a ministry of culture whose job it was to identify, document, and promote local culture. And Leo was part of that process. So the collection includes roughly, I think, 200 to 300 recordings that Leo himself did in these countries in Africa. And again, every country practically is represented. But beyond that, he also then would receive copies from Radio Tanzania, Radio Comoros, Radio whatever, when they would finish making their own recordings. And they would send courtesy copies to him in thanks for the effort that he did in training them. So then we have a whole bunch of recordings that were produced on the continent by these new radio stations as part of the collection as well. And in some of those cases, such as Radio Sierra Leone and Radio Liberia, that of course suffered years and years of civil war, the originals no longer exist. So the only copies that exist in the world are the ones that we have in Leo's collection. Beyond that, he was sent by VOA to cover major events. So for instance, when Louis Armstrong performed at the Tunis Festival in Carthage in 1967, the only known recording that we have of it is here in the Leo Sarkisian collection. So, and the very first recording of Fela Kuti, one of the most famous artists ever to come out of West Africa, a 1965 recording before he had really made it big, is also in this collection, as is one of the first recordings of Bembeya Jazz from Guinea, and I could go on. But so there's an amazing wealth.
And I saw tell me if this is right, more than 10,000 audio reels, along with all the 45 RPM singles and the cassette tapes. It's mind-boggling.
It is. It's an incredible. A lot of those reels are also full of information because they're Leo's shows. Twice a week, Music Time in Africa was broadcast. And each of these half-hour shows has, you know, not only the music, but sometimes interviews with musicians that Leo carried out. So it's a wealth of information that we will take many a year to parse through in order to catalog and understand what's in all of it.
And how did this all end up in Ann Arbor?
Well, I met Leo 18 years ago right here at the University of Michigan. I had not yet acquired my position. I had not yet even finished my PhD, and I was presenting at a small gathering hosted by our former vice provost for senior vice provost for academic affairs, Lester Mons, who is himself an ethnomusicologist and a specialist on Liberia. So I was at this gathering that Lester had called together of specialists on African music. Leo was also there. And from that moment, I came to know of the value of his collection. Once I became a professor here at the University of Michigan in 1999, 3 years after that first meeting, I made it a point to sort of work with Leo to try to get a sense of cataloging the master tapes that he himself had recorded, and then secondarily all the master tapes from the radio stations in Africa that he had been sent. We then cataloged his LP collection, the 45s, and bit by bit made our way through it. Then this past summer we got the alarm message that the Voice of America needed the space that is currently occupied by Leo's collection. And it's a vast, as you said, tens of thousands of reels. These are not small paper items. So we went to work trying to convince the powers that be here at the University of Michigan that rather than allow the whole collection to go into a former salt mine in Pennsylvania, which is the plan of the day, into deep storage where it would never see the light of day. That if we could at least just house it, curate it, catalog it, and slowly raise the funds necessary to start digitizing it, that we would be preserving a very, very important collection.
Leo, you must be very, very happy to know that all of your years of loving work aren't going to wind up in a salt mine somewhere, that they are going to be out there living as students and scholars study the work and learn from what you did.
Well, that is the most important satisfaction for all the years that I've worked with that music, is that it is, the collection has found a very important home.
And Kelly, thanks to the connection you made with Leo, now this is here in Michigan. There's got to be so many disciplines that are going to be able to benefit from studying this very valuable and rare African music.
Indeed.
Kelly Askew is the founding director of U of M's African Studies Center. She's an associate professor in the Departments of Anthropology and Afro-American and African Studies, and a very key player in bringing the Leo Sarkisian Collection of African Music to the University of Michigan. And we've had the honor of talking with Leo Sarkisian, who has such a legendary career as an ethnomusicologist, a broadcaster for The Voice of America, who spent his lifetime being a one-man ambassador for America and collecting music from Africa. Thank you so much, Leo, for taking time to talk with us.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
After graduating from Michigan State University in 2010, Connor McGaffey of Troy couldn't land a full-time job in his field. But a chance encounter with foam dart guns, yeah, you heard that correctly, foam dart guns, uncorked a novel business idea. That idea is now the 4,000-square-foot Detroit Dart Club, located in the Russell Industrial Center in Detroit's Midtown.
I'm at the point where I want to do something I enjoy doing, and I haven't really been doing that. Pretty much learned every job I don't want to do since I graduated college. A little over a year ago, some buddies and I came across the Nerf section, and I was just blown away at all the different blasters they had. So I was like, we're going to have to get some Nerf guns. So we took them home and, tipped over the furniture. I was in my kitchen, and my friends are just raining darts, and I am giggling like a little boy. And I was like, this is a lot of fun. This is like actual fun. And a lot of people like saw what we were doing and wanted to get involved and like join in. So we'd have friends of friends coming in, and it was really fun. And I was just like, you know what? This is a lot of fun. So I was like, I'll do some research. It took me a while to find like a location. Someone suggested me to the Russell Industrial Center. So I met with Eric Novak, who is one of the building managers. He's like, what are you looking for a space for? And I was like, Nerf Wars. And he's like, no problem. Yeah, we got spaces for that. And I was like, great. Your team, you come up with like a strategy, and you can't go in with no strategy. You'll just lose. So usually you'll have one person in the base with a rampage shooting people, one other person up the line doing cover fire while you try to get the guys with the mega blasters to get to the front line and shoot down the targets. We have a lot of blasters, which we hang all in the bases, and we have like some of the special league blasters. So we have rocket launchers, and thunder bow and arrows. Those are a lot of fun. So my favorite blasters is probably the Rampage, mostly because you can get a lot of shots in, and they're fun to use. They sound pretty good, like the reloading, loading the magazines. That's fun to do. These can actually leave a welt if you have like some exposed skin. I really wanted this to be in Detroit just because there's kind of like a buzz going on. I'm going to change the definition of dart in Detroit, and it's going to be Nerf.
That was Connor McGaffey of the Detroit Dart Club in Midtown Detroit. Stateside's Mike Blank brought us that audio postcard. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's turn our attention to money. Is there anything new this year that might help us in budgeting or saving or investing? Brian O'Connor is the personal finance editor for the Detroit News and the author of The $1,000 Challenge, How One Family Slashed Its Budget Without Moving Under a Bridge or Living on Government Cheese. Brian, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
Does Uncle Sam have any New Year's gifts for us to perhaps help save a little more or make our dollars go further?
Well, the best thing is there are some higher limits now on your savings accounts, especially if you are over 50. You have a catch-up option, which a lot of people in pre-retirement need to do, and that's gone up to $6,000 over the $18,000 that you can put in if you've got a 401k or a similar kind of workplace plan. You know, a lot of us can't sock away $24,000 a year in a 401k, but it is a good thing to do if you're sort of within that last 15 or 10 years to retirement, is to look at that. So that limit went up.
Why was there such a big catch-up needed for the over 50 set?
It's often because a lot of people just don't get serious about retirement savings until they're in that last 10 years or so. Typically, when they've got the kids out of the house, they might have the mortgage paid off. And so that's a time when you concentrate a lot of savings. It's also good because in that time, that's also typically when you're going to be earning your highest paycheck so that you can actually find that cash to set aside.
And then for the under 50 set, what, it's going up by $500?
Yes, you're up to about $18,000, but it's going to vary. You know, it depends on your plan. You know, you may have a workplace plan that cuts you off at 15. And, of course, with these pre-tax plans, the first thing to remember is no matter what you're doing, try and get up to at least the maximum for the employer match. If your employer matches 50% of your contribution up to 3% of your pay, then putting in 3% is actually means you're saving 4.5%. So that just gave you a 50% return on your money no matter what you invest in. I talked to somebody who could not get her 401k funded because she was daunted by the 14 mutual funds that she had to choose from. And I said, if you go up to the employer match, it doesn't matter. You can choose the biggest loser and you're still making money. You know, the Outer Slobovian Yak Futures Fund is going to make you money because you're getting the employer match. So people should just be starting at that kind of level. And in fact, there is a good little trick that I call the 2% solution. No matter what kind of plan you're on, whatever you're doing right now, just add 2% as an increase this year for the next couple of years until you can get to that point where you're saving maybe somewhere between 12 to 15% because you're not going to really feel it. It doesn't hurt your take-home pay that much because it's pre-tax. And it's a kind of a painless way that people can sort of automate this and yet ramp it up to a point where they've got a significant amount of savings.
Let's say that I have decided that this is the year, or you kind of set me up for this now. So this is the year I'm finally going to build a budget and try to live within that budget. And I've not done this before. So what is the best way to get launched in the right direction?
My advice is always to start where you are and look at how much money have you got coming in this month and where does it need to go. Look at your fixed expenses like your rent or your mortgage, any loan payments that you have, and your general overhead for electric and gas and insurance and that. And then the rest of that is your discretionary spending, and that's what you're going to have to make work for you till the end of the month. That's all you really need to do right there is be focused on looking ahead and where do I want my money to go. And then after that, you can use the approach that I used when I wrote the book, The $1,000 Challenge, which is start focusing on your biggest spending categories and try to get those down to the point where you can sort of focus on one thing at a time. The easiest ones are the big fixed categories so that if you go out and shop around on your home insurance or your car insurance and you lower that bill, as soon as you're done for the year. Other categories like groceries, entertainment, dining out, things like that, those are the places where you have to sort of be ever vigilant. Some weeks you're going to just nail that, and some weeks you're just going to, you know, be running around like a crazy person and maybe not be that successful, and that's okay. Don't try to be perfect. Be happy if you're saving one more dollar this week than you were a week ago.
I heard someone over the holidays toss out what I thought was a pretty cool idea, that every time you go to the ATM, set one of those 20s aside. Just put it away. It's easy to kind of slice that off if you can do that. And I suppose over the course of a year, that could build up pretty nicely.
All those kinds of little tricks can really work for you. It could be every time I'm doing something discretionary. So when I get my spending money for the week, I'm going to set aside 20. Another program that people like is the dollar a week program, where you start the first week of the year, you put a dollar aside, then you put $2 aside, then you put $3 aside. If you do that, by the time you get to the end of the year, you'll have, I think, about $1,300 or so. At the end, you're putting aside about $200 a month if you're doing a dollar a week. But if you've had the year to sort of build up to that, and you're kind of looking for that. So there are those kinds of little tricks that you can do. If you're doing it methodically over time, it's kind of very satisfying to sort of see that cash build up in the envelope.
Great tips. Brian O'Connor, the personal finance editor for the Detroit News, and he's author of The $1,000 Challenge, How One Family Slashed Its Budget Without Moving Under a Bridge or Living on Government Cheese. Always good to talk with you, Brian. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
Intuition.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
There is no straight path from your seat today to where you are going. Don't try to draw that line. You will not just get it wrong. You will miss big opportunities.
And we're back with the next idea, discussing ways to move Michigan forward. Today, we turn to education and the arts. Mitchell Robinson is with us now. He's an associate professor of music education and area chair of music education at the Michigan State University College of Music. Mitchell, new ideas in education are really crucial to preparing Michigan's next generation for the future. And we've heard a lot of talk about the importance of pushing those STEM subjects. We hear science, technology, engineering, and math, especially K through 12. But you're arguing there is one more subject we really need to focus on, and that is music. Why is that?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to make sure that we're offering our children a broad, rich, and comprehensive education. I've got nothing against any of the subjects that are components of STEM. I have children of my own, and I want them to get a good education in those subjects as well. But to think that we are going to be able to offer a complete education by focusing on one small suite of subjects and ignoring the richness and diversity of education, I think, is short-sighted, and it's not going to lead us to the population that we want.
What important skills does music teach that students aren't going to get elsewhere, let's say in those STEM courses?
In the words of one of my heroes, Elliot Eisner, one of the things that music teaches children, and adults for that matter, is it gives them the thinking skills to know what to do when you don't know what to do. Most of the subjects that we teach kids in schools are very good at what's called convergent thinking, which is finding the right answer to a question. Music and the arts help children to understand what to do when we don't know what the right answer is, and when, in fact, like most of life, there's more than one right or appropriate answer to a question. It also gives kids a chance to be musical. And I worry sometimes that in our zeal to make music and art and physical education seem more credible and real, that we kind of give up the essence of what those disciplines are about. The best reason for teaching music is so that children become musical. I feel like sometimes we run away from that reason, and we're more worried about offering what we do as a way to help kids improve in other subjects. The jury, I think, is out. The research on whether music helps kids do better in math and science and reading, I think, is very inconclusive. And for most people, that's not why they study music or art. It's not a bait and switch. We're not studying music so that we get a better SAT or ACT score. We're studying music because we want to know more about music. We want to be musical. We want to express ourselves in musical ways. It's been part of the curriculum in American schools for over 150 years, and really the move that we're seeing now to narrow the curriculum to the subjects that are emphasized in STEM, that's kind of the next idea that shouldn't be a next idea.
So why do you think it is that music is often one of the first subjects to get slashed when a district faces budget problems? In fact, in your essay for the next idea, you point to Lansing Schools, which laid off nearly all its certified teachers in music, in art, and in phys ed. What does that say to you?
It says to me that we in music have not done a good enough job of showing people why what we do is important. And sometimes even our own colleagues aren't sure why we're teaching music. And again, I think it has to do with what we just talked about, that in the arts, I think a lot of times we shy away
from defending and justifying and rationalizing what we do on the basis of what we do. We're always looking for extrinsic reasons for why music is important. I have no problem with people thinking that music or art or physical education have benefits beyond becoming musical and artistic and more physically fit. But that's really what those subjects are about. And the vast majority of parents and community members want those things for their children. I think it's really problematic that the places that those subjects tend to be first on the chopping block are in our urban schools. Even Arnie Duncan has talked about how a lack of access to music and art in urban schools is a civil rights issue. The children in the suburbs really don't have problems getting access to music instruction taught by certified teachers in public school. It's really more of a localized problem in the big cities.
And of course,
and that doesn't seem right or fair.
And of course, Arnie Duncan being the Secretary of Education, so that's that national right. view. What do you think this current system that we have then with these kinds of classes on the chopping block, what is that leaving us with in terms of Michigan's music education programs?
Well, I'd say two things. One, it's leaving us impoverished. It's leaving us with a choir that doesn't have all the voices that deserve to be there. So the choir of voices that are going to be from children that have access to good, solid music programs is going to be overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly middle and upper class. But we're also going to miss a humanistic element to our education if we focus only on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. I think most people that are engaged in those subjects would tell you that without a full and rich, complete education that includes music, the arts, humanities, that what they learn in the STEM subjects is not going to be as complete or as meaningful.
Let's talk about the teachers. How are music teachers currently evaluated for effectiveness in Michigan?
Well, they're evaluated in a myriad ways, but increasingly what we're seeing is that the state is demanding that up to 50% of their evaluation is determined by standardized test scores in math and reading, which is a little bit like going out for lunch at McDonald's and then evaluating your meal based on what Burger King is serving up next door. It just doesn't make any sense.
So what do you make of this as an educator, of this focus on education, on accountability and measuring results? Are we testing the right things to make sure our kids are prepared for jobs in the new century?
I think that we are obsessed with numbers. I think we're fascinated with data. And again, I don't have any problem with data. I think sometimes we need numbers to make good decisions. But what we're doing right now is we're taking subjects that are easy to test and substituting that for subjects that are meaningful to know more about.
You train young music teachers at MSU, Mitchell. What do you hear from them as they graduate and then they head out to start teaching in Michigan schools?
Well, sadly, more and more of them are choosing to teach not in Michigan but in other places. And that's a change in the past 10 or 11 years, too. Most of the students when I first got here were looking for jobs in the state. And because of a lot of the changes in teacher evaluation and because of some of the interpretations of teacher certification rules and trends, more and more of our students, in fact, we've got 11 students that were graduating, and more than half of them are looking for jobs out of state. And that's a brain drain. We're producing fantastic teachers in Michigan. We have great colleges and schools of education, and more we're producing great teachers for other states and not for our state, and I think that's a problem.
Mitchell, your next idea involved a couple of policy recommendations you had to shore up music education for future generations in Michigan. Tell us what they are.
Mm-hmm. Number one, we are one of four or five states currently in the United States that does not have a requirement or a mandate for music in elementary grades. I think that's a long overdue change that we need to effect at the state level. Right now, it's not required that local school districts offer music taught by a certified music teacher. Our neighboring states all do have that requirement, and I think, you know, at some point we're going to see a real difference in the quality of education that we're able to offer to the kids in Michigan. Another thing would be in the way that teachers are certified and in the interpretation of the certification rules. One of the reasons that the school district in Lansing was allowed or permitted to get rid of all the elementary art, music, and PE teachers is because the state currently allows schools to assign teachers with a K-8 all subject cert to teach any subject. I think that the classroom teachers who teach, say, second grade or third grade would be among the first people to tell you that they can play a record, they can play a CD, they can finger paint with students, but they're not qualified or really ready to teach music or art as a real subject in the schools. Again, that's in many states, that's already a requirement, and we're behind the eight ball there. And then the third next idea for me would be that we need to adjust the teacher evaluation system so that teachers are only evaluated in the subjects that they teach and by the work of students that they actually have in their class. That is not currently the case. Sadly, we're not the only state that has that, but that's more of a national problem, but we can address it here in Michigan if we have the courage to do that.
Are you ultimately optimistic about the future of music education in Michigan?
I'm frighteningly optimistic because I get to see great music teachers work every day. My job lets me get out into public schools in the state, and we have amazingly strong music programs in most of the communities in our state. When I see the power that music has to help children make sense of their lives, I'm enormously optimistic. When I see my students, as enthusiastic as they are, even knowing the obstacles and challenges that are in front of them before they get into the classroom, I'm very optimistic. The teachers that we're preparing to enter the workforce right now are the best prepared teachers that I've ever seen. So I'm optimistic if we can get the policy issues straightened out, that the impact and the promise of what music has to offer for children in schools is a game changer in Michigan and beyond.
We'd like to wrap up each Next Idea conversation with a question for you to discuss. So here goes. Our contributor, Mitch Robinson, has made his case for why a high-quality music education is so important, no matter what you do later in life. Well, what about you? How has studying music made an impact on your life? Share your thoughts on Twitter at NextIdeaMI. That's at NextIdeaMI, or on Michigan Radio's Facebook page, or the Next Idea link at MichiganRadio.org. And that is where you will find Mitch's essay that we have just been talking about. Mitchell Robinson, Michigan State University College of Music, thank you so much.
Thank you. Pleasure to talk.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.